This is an interview with Mr. Jack D. Levin for the State Historical Society of Wisconsin by Peter Gordy. Interview held in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on April 27th, 1975. Tape 1, Side 1.
Okay. Your name, sir?
My name is Jack Levin, Jack D. Levin. Mm. I was born in Milwaukee, 1907.
1907. Now,
goes back a few years.
Yeah. Now, what did your father and mother do?
Well, at the time, I don't remember what my dad did at the time I was born. Mm-hmm. He might have been a fruit peddler for a little while. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. But all around 1912 or 1911, he went into he bought a tavern, mm-hmm. called a saloon in those days.
Yeah.
They weren't quite as fancy then, you know, they called them saloons. And this was on 6th Street, mm-hmm. right in the heart of the ghetto. It
yeah.
wasn't called a ghetto
right.
then, but all the Jewish people lived there. And we were probably about a block away from the old Haymarket, which mm. was quite an institution in Milwaukee in those days. And, you know, stopping to think, I'm trying to remember how many saloons were on that block, actually between Cherry and Vliet Street,
uh-huh.
on 6th Street, on both sides. There must have been at least a half a dozen saloons. But they were, in those days, they were social institutions, you know.
Yeah.
We had no Jewish clientele there. They were all Russians. Russians of the old school who had no families here, and many of them were lumberjacks, and they depended on the saloon keeper to be their father confessor, their guide, no matter what happened. See? I mean, if you're interested, I happen to remember an incident. I happen to remember an incident when I was a little fellow. You know, judge of the circuit court, Nealon, Harvey Nealon?
Yeah.
Well, his father was a police justice. Neil B. Nealon, and he was also my father's attorney, and they were very good friends. And I can remember they were on what was then Chestnut Street, now called Juneau Avenue. The police, the central police station was there and all that sort of thing. So at any rate, I can remember one day, telephone rings, and Judge Nealon is on the other end, and he says, Joe, he says, I got a couple of Russians here, and I can't understand them. He says, could you come down and help me out?
Wow.
So of course saloon keepers always had plenty of time, and my mother was the right hand there, so she could handle the institution while my dad was gone. So we walked over to Chestnut Street, and here are a couple of Russians whom my dad knew, and they had both been drunk, and one had taken a beer bottle and hit the other on the head. But with their thick skulls, I guess it didn't make too much difference. But they were sorry for what they did, so my dad talked to them, and he said, well, Your Honor, he said, they're very good friends. They didn't know what they were doing. They had too much to drink. They're sorry for what they did. So the judge says, well, Joe, what do you think I ought to do? He says, why don't you charge them a dollar in cost? Dollar in cost? Thanks. When I told that to Harvey Nealon, he practically rolled. He says, justice was really simple in those days.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was just a little aside.
Right. A good aside. Where did your folks come from? The old country.
Well, my folks came from an area near Brest-Litovsk, I suppose that's the nearest city. It would probably be Rus-Poland, the area
yeah.
of Poland that was acquired by Russia after the big division. Part of it went to, I think, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, part of it went to Germany, and so on. So, and my dad got here after serving a four-year hitch in the Russian army. It was mandatory. He got here about 1903, I believe. And then he sent for my mother. They were engaged in the old country. They both came to Chicago where they had relatives.
Yeah.
And my dad worked at Swift and Company. I think he earned about $2 a week. My mother got a job in a dressmaking shop of some type or another, and she earned $3 a week. Well, that didn't sit too well with my dad. So after a bit anyway, they came to Milwaukee and they got married, and I think my mother said that they had $40 between them saved up when they got married. Well,
yeah.
Nowadays, I suppose kids need a little more than that, don't they?
Yeah.
So, and I think my dad looked around for something to do here, and somebody told him, well, why don't you get a horse and wagon and start peddling fruit? I think he lasted 1 week, and after a couple of reactions with some of his prospective customers that he didn't like, he was a pretty rough character and pretty independent. He said, well, this I don't have to take from anybody, and he just gave it up, I think, after about a week.
Yeah.
He got some other jobs, I don't know, he did a few other things, and eventually, about 1911, he went into the saloon business with my uncle, and after about a year or two, he bought him out, and he continued on his own until about the fall of 1914. And he didn't feel too well at the time, and I think there must have been an urge, because in the old country, he had worked for some of his relatives and others on a farm and had certain agricultural pursuits, and he had a feeling for that anyway, and so it didn't take too much urging for him to go back. Anyway, he wanted to try it again. So in the fall of 1914, he bought an 80-acre farm in Racine County, Wisconsin, town of Raymond, about 15 or 18 miles south of Milwaukee, about a couple of miles into the Racine County area. And this was a nice 80-acre farm. I don't remember the area, I think that road might be called the 7 Mile Road. Maybe that is, I never was quite sure, but I think it was right off the 7 Mile Road. And originally this farm was known as the old Nobles farm. There was a Dr. Nobles and a father of his who had lived in that area for many years, and apparently at one time this farm had been owned by him. So it was 80 acres, and we had a nice orchard there. We had a nice orchard on that land, and my dad, having lived in the cities for many years, had to get down to brass tacks again and relearn the working of the soil. He'd find out some things from his neighbors and so forth. We had an Irish neighbor about a half of a mile down there named Garrity. He'd been down there for many years, and there were some across the street and so forth. So at any rate, and the things that we didn't know, my dad made me, how old was I in those days? 1914, 1915, 7, 8 years old maybe, but I could write, and if we needed some information, he'd say, well, write to the county agent, or write to the state in Madison. Well, I'd write, and after a period of time, some answers would come back, and we'd translate them so that we understood them, and we went ahead and we worked. So at any rate, there was one thing, of course, being Jewish, my father didn't want to have any pigs. There was a lot of money in hogs, but my father said, no, I'm a Jew, I don't want to have chazerim around here. But we had, I would say, possibly at various times, maybe 20 or 22 Holstein cows, which gave us a good deal of milk, which we sent to the city, to the, I think, Gridley Dairy Company at the time, used to pick it up at intervals, and pasteurize and so forth. We had possibly 6 horses, I think, and maybe anywhere from 600 to 800 chickens. And it was really something to watch my mother get out there in the morning with her long fartach. Now, fartach is an old country Yiddish name for an apron. Fartach.
Yeah.
At any rate, she'd get out there with the chicken feet and chick, 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 chick. And why, they'd run over there. The moment they saw or heard or saw the others running, boy, they'd come over there like nobody's business. And there are things that occur. For example, I might have had my eye on a cute young rooster over there that maybe he pushed some of the hens apart and he was over there first, as if to say, well, look, this is my show, or I'm tougher than you are, and I'm going to get my share before you get yours. And maybe a couple of days later, I wouldn't see him around. We'd have chicken that day. Well, I couldn't eat chicken. So, of course, there was a little problem between my father and myself. And these are some of the things that come back to you, you know.
Right.
We had a couple of dogs on the farm, and I know that when my dad would go to the city with a load of something or other, and he'd be coming back late at night alone, maybe a mile or two away from the farm. Here was this dog barking, he'd be over there to meet him. Now, what motivated that dog, or what sense or what instinct got involved there, I don't know. But he was there to welcome my father on his way back.
Can you remember from whom you bought the farm? Or was it 7 years old at the time?
We bought the farm from the old Nobles estate.
Mm-hmm.
N-O-B-L-E-S, Noble mm-hmm. Staff. And I can remember, of course, my dad didn't have that much money. We had a, I think we had a, of course, farms were cheaper in those days, but we had a substantial mortgage on it, and it took us a number of years to pay it off. And I can recall that the barn was in much better condition than the house, because my dad always had a, he always had an argument that I guess we couldn't refute. He said, well, we make our living off the barn. And I suppose he figured that the humans, his family, could maybe shift for themselves. It was an old house. We had no electricity. We had no telephone. We had no inside water. We had no inside toilet. We had a conventional, we had the kind of a toilet that Chick Sales used to write about in his book. Remember, he wrote a book called The Specialist? Maybe you don't remember that, but Chick Sales was quite a character. Quick change artist, used to come around to the various fairs and Chautauquas, and I remember seeing him a few times. But he wrote a book about the specialist, who was a specialist on building these outdoor privies. Well, we had one of those. It was a two-holer. And I will say this, that in the wintertime, it was quite a problem. And of course, we didn't have ordinary toilet paper in those days. We used the Sears and Roebuck catalog, you know? And there were certain sections that were good, and there were, and there were, and there was harder paper that couldn't be used, you see. So, as part of our deal, water, well, we had a cistern to catch rainwater. Mm. And of course, we had a hand pump in the so-called summer kitchen, which was an additional kitchen at the back of the house. You did a lot of your work in the summer kitchens and so forth. You did your washing there and things of that sort. So we had a cistern with a hand pump, and we would have soft water for washing. Now for drinking, we had a well outside. Now that well supplied the cattle, the horses, and so forth with drinking water, and it was operated by a windmill. In later years, well, maybe after a year or two, I think my dad got a gasoline engine, because the windmill didn't always spin. There wasn't always enough wind, and frequently we had to do a lot of hand pumping. So to get away from that, my dad finally bought a Lawson engine, L-A-U-S-O-N. I guess this character Lawson had a University of Lawsonomy or something down here.
Yeah, right
on Highway 41.
Yeah.
That used to be called the Kilburn Road, but I don't know. I see this sign continually, but I don't know what they do, really. But it was that same Lawson who used to build gasoline engines. We had one of those. And so drinking water, of course, we would carry in a galvanized pail to the house, and we had a dipper, and this was drinking water. Electricity we didn't have in those days. So what did we have for light? We had one of these Aladdin lamps. It was a kerosene lamp that hung in the kitchen, and we had a mantle on it. And this thing gave quite a bit of light. In the barns, of course, we used the conventional barn lanterns. You know, I mean, they had a certain amount of, they had kerosene and a little wick, and that's about all. So that's interesting to recall these things.
How many of you were there?
Well, there were dad and mother and five children, three boys and two girls. I was the oldest. We had a couple of girls in between, and then a couple of boys. And they were all in this general area. I don't know whether you need any background on them.
That's all right.
I don't know. My youngest brother, Dr. Jules Levin, is a neurosurgeon in this area. And the next brother, David, is... I call him a plutocrat. He's been in Washington for 35 years. He has a PhD in law and economics and a CPA, and he's Mr. Expressways United States today. He's been in Washington for many years. He works in the Department of Transportation, and he's in charge of all expressways for the country. Here's a lawyer and an accountant who has practiced neither law or accounting, yet he's been active, and David was on the Board of Governors of the American Bar and so on. Anyway, Jules, incidentally, was a past president of the Milwaukee County Medical Society. And my older sister, well, they're all younger, but I'm just putting them in a relative position. My older sister, Min, who lives in Madison these many years, is retired now. And for many years, she was a research technologist medical technologist at the university. And my younger sister is a graduate nurse, one of the first group to graduate from the University of Wisconsin with a degree in medicine, in the days when they used to have a dormitory there and all that sort of thing. So there's the family, and of course they have children of their own, and things have developed, you know. But it's been very interesting.
It sounds as if the folks sent you off to school and motivated you.
Well, I graduated 11, and for 2 years I didn't go anywhere. Mm. And maybe one of the reasons that my folks returned to the city was the fact that the children were graduating. Mm. That there wasn't, except at a distance, that there wasn't a chance for further education. Yeah. And there was very little opportunity for Jewish education there. You know, it's an odd situation. Are you interested in some of the Jewish background?
Absolutely.
You are. Well, prior to our leaving for the farm, I had had possibly 6 months of what we call cheder, Hebrew school. In those days we called it cheder, under a rabbi called Shostak. He was then one of the better Hebrew teachers in the city, and we'd go there after school, and we'd study liturgical Hebrew, the prayers, and so forth. So it was maybe 6 months. At any rate, for the first month or two, my dad's conscience must have bothered him somewhat, because he'd say, well, sit down, and we'll read. And so we'd open up the sitter, and I would read a little. But after the first month, I think his conscience began to bother him less and less, and he got involved with work and so forth. So we didn't do very much anymore. And I can remember my dad coming in after working out in the field. And, oh, by the way, I recall that my dad was a charter subscriber to a Yiddish newspaper called Der Tog, published in New York. I think it's no longer published. At a later date, they combined with the Morning Journal. Yeah. But this came out in 1914, and my dad was a charter subscriber. And until the day of his death, for 50 years, he was a continuous subscriber to this paper. Now, we were not well enough to do, or we couldn't afford an English paper and a Yiddish paper, so we got the Yiddish paper. And so my mother would say to my dad, "You want some Yiddish in this too, or don't you want any Yiddish
sure.
in this?" My dad would say to him, "Yitzchok, les me rapes a roman or the rapes a bissel nais, in the flex zirven socken. You versteht was es heißt, zirven socken? In old country Yiddish, to zirven socken means to darn socks."
Yeah.
And incidentally, just as a side, the Yiddish seems to be changed by every country in which the Jews live. See, now this was old country Yiddish, to which I was exposed. Of course, the modern day Yiddish, we take English words and we just give them a Yiddish flavor, and all of a sudden it becomes part of Americanized Yiddish.
Yeah.
But the old country Jew can't understand that.
Yeah.
For example, if you were to say a carpenter or a plumber, well, so the Jew would say a kapetner or a plumber. But if you were to talk to an old country Jew, he would have no conception in the world as to what you were talking about. Okay. To get back anyway, so my mother would say, "Yitzchok, les me rapes nais." So his reaction was, "Was hakst du mir a chainik? A man arbeits a hund am ganzen Tag in Feld, muss er noch gehen lesen Bobbermeises in Roman." So my mother, being a very patient woman, you know, she'd say to me, "Yosele," my name in Hebrew is Yosef, although in English it's Jack. That's another story, but not germane. At any rate, Yosele, du hast da gehat a bissel Hebrew, meaning you have studied some Hebrew. What did I have in Hebrew? I knew the Aleph Beis.
Yeah.
That's about the same thing. So, through necessity and with time, I began to put words together, and to this day, I read, write, and speak Yiddish fluently. Mm. It paid off, and would you believe it or not, my dad had quite a collection of books in Yiddish. And since in the school library, the little rural school library, we didn't have enough to read, and I was a voracious reader. I just couldn't get enough to read, no matter what it was. So even though this was in Yiddish, I read Robinson Crusoe, and I don't know how many other stories that my dad had in Yiddish before I was able to find the books in English.
Wow.
It was fantastic, really. And this is the way it was, you know, and even years to come, my dad would always play a game with me. long after I was married and traveled, I'd come back, he'd say to me, "Sasha, vergessen für zu lesen Yiddish." I said, "Pa, what are you giving me?" I didn't forget anything. So he'd shove a paper under my nose, "Les, read." So I'd read a couple of stuff up in vergessen. Oh, this was almost like a game.
Yeah.
So, say, by the way, you know, I happen to think of something. It's really funny. We didn't have milking machines in those days. Yeah. They were just coming in, but only the richer farmers could afford them, who had tremendously large herds. And some of the farmers felt that it was too much of a strain on the cow. And so they still continued to milk by hand.
Yeah.
And so we'd bring the cows in and put them into their heads were held by what we call stanchions.
Yeah.
And we'd give them some hay and things like that, or green soybeans.
Yeah.
You know, we'd cut a bunch of something to make them happy, or alfalfa.
Yeah.
And put it in the manger, and the cow is eating, and she's very happy and very relaxed. And so we'd sit ourselves down on our three-legged stool and have our pail between our legs, and we'd be milking away. Well, being young and being strong, I think I was—I could milk two cows to my folks one. All three of us milked, my mother, my dad, and myself. But I could milk two to their one. You know, I was strong and it was a game. Now, my mother at that time used to have about three or four cats. Mm. The farmers used to call them ratters. Well, you know, there are mice around there. You've got corn, you've got grain. You need cats to police the premises. And the cats, it was a game with them, you know. Yeah. They really get after the mice.
Yeah.
So here, a couple of them are walking through the barn, and I happened to see one, so I just squirted some milk at her. I mean, it's the funniest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And it got her around the face. She started to lick, and all of a sudden, meow! So at the time that you got the meow, I timed it so that the milk got right into her. And you know, this carried on for a long time. Every time I went milking, those two cats in particular, who had experience in this sort of operation, would just march along and meow, bing, meow. People would laugh, but it was the truth.
Yeah.
It was the darkest thing. And you know, another thing that comes back to, my teacher liked me, and I used to like to go to school, and I used to like to study things. So she prepared me for a 3 hours contest. Mm. In the country schools and the rural schools particularly, they have these 3 hours contests, you know. And so you have a test in the school, and if you make that, then you go to the township test, and then if you make the township, then you take the county test. If you make the county, then you go down to the state fair. And I can remember that I was preparing myself for the spelling test. I was a pretty good speller, I thought, and my sister Min would sit on the steps going up to the haymow while I was milking, and we'd go through speller after speller, speller after speller, words, complicated words, and so anyway, the payoff was I finally got through and I represented Racine County at the state fair. I don't remember the year, it had to be about 1918 probably, somewhere. And maybe I was a little overconfident, and I thought that I could spell, and I misspelled one word. The girl beat me, and I felt so bad at the time. Something. Well, that's the teacher I have to look up.
Yeah, right.
I mentioned earlier to you that I haven't seen this teacher for since 1918, and I finally found out where she lives. I'm going to try to see her.
Yes.
That was the teacher.
Yeah,
that was really something.
Amazing.
But you know, speaking of types of crops and things like that, most farmers around there used to raise a lot of grain or a lot of hay, and they'd have a bunch of cattle and pigs and so forth, and they'd have corn, of course. These were crops that didn't require too much attention. I mean, you could kind of mass produce these without knocking yourself out.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't that much money in these things either. And so my dad finally decided, well, we're going to have 10 acres of cabbage, and we're going to have 10 acres of potatoes. And to raise 10 acres of cabbage and 10 acres of potatoes by hand means is really backbreaking work. We did have a cabbage planter, and the cabbage planter had a barrel upon which the seat was mounted, and the driver, in this case my father, would sit over there, and he'd have a team of horses. And in the back of it, two of us would be sitting, one on each side at a much lower level we had several pieces of burlap on our knees, and we were piled up with cabbage plants. And we also had a fertilizer attachment. So as this planter would go, it would click, click. At every click, there would be a little furrow, and there would be a certain predetermined amount of fertilizer and a certain amount of water. And we'd have to take the cabbage plants and just keep on feeding them. And the thing was set for certain spacing, see? So this we did mechanically, and we enjoyed it. And if the horses would start to run sometimes, that wouldn't faze us. I mean, we were both two young men, one of the neighbor boys and myself, and we would plant cabbage for my folks and for some of the others too, you know. Well, in other words, if the farmer boy came over to help us, well, then I went over to help him. I mean, we used to trade, work that way. Of course, the harvesting of the cabbage was by hand. And we'd have these big farm wagons with bang boards, you know, high boards so that we wouldn't throw the heads over.
Yeah.
And we'd have these things like, what do you call these old chopping knives? You know, like the women used to have a kind of a semicircular chopping knife that you'd use in a wooden bowl. If you wanted to chop onions or something like that, a chopper. Well, we'd use those, you know. We'd sharpen them up and chop those, grab a hold of the cabbage head and bing, 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 you know. And this is the way we'd harvest the cabbage. And of course, since most of this was late cabbage, we'd really have to work pretty hard so that we wouldn't lose any of it to the early frost. So we'd have to be watch the weather and things of that sort. Potatoes, here again, we planted the potatoes with a potato planter. Now, the potato planter was a kind of a low thing with a continuous moving chain, and it had a little box or a little slot.
A little box, a little slot.
Okay. Is that on or off now?
It's on.
Oh, it's on. A little box, a little slot. Well, here, first of all, there's a large box or so where you had your potato seed in.
Mm.
Now, I don't know whether you're familiar with seed potatoes.
I
mean, you cut them into pieces so that they have at least one or two eyes on them.
Right.
You mean you're quite a farmer yourself?
Not really. Just had some gardening experience in
Denmark.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So at any rate, this large box would feed these pieces piece by piece onto this moving belt.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't too much of a job. And of course, it would plant it, and then right behind it, you had a couple of discs that would mound up the ground behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no big problem. Now, with the harvesting of potatoes in those days, automatic potato harvesters were unknown. But the only thing that was available at the time was a potato digger.
Mm-hmm.
And this potato digger would had a kind of a plow-like portion in the front, and you could set it for the proper depth. And after the potatoes were ready for harvest, why, you'd go along the mounds, and it would lift it up and then shake it out.
Yeah.
So the ground would be shaken out, and then the potatoes would be dropped on top.
Yeah.
But you still had to pick them up by hand.
Yeah.
And here again, the problems of early frosts were problems. And I can remember there were times when the weather forecasts alerted us to the fact that we're going to have an early frost. We might lose our potatoes. And this made the difference between having a few dollars at the end of the year and not having anything, maybe working all year for nothing. And so we'd work till 12 o'clock at night and under the moon, you know.
Wow.
And we'd really get everything. And I tell you, we were tired and knocked out, but we were strong, you know.
Yeah.
We felt good.
Yeah.
I mean, physically, you felt good. Now let's see. I remember when we were out haying, for example. So we had a hay mower. Now the hay mower was operated with a team of horses, and it had a long sickle and so forth. Nowadays people use tractors, but those days we used horses. We didn't own a tractor. And we'd work out and we'd cut the hay, and then when it dried, it laid out until it dried, and then we'd have a hay rake, possibly operated by a single horse. And we'd arrange the hay in long rows or windrows so that eventually we'd come along there with our hay loader, which would straddle these rows and pick up the hay and put it onto the hay rack. Well, of course, when we worked out in the field, maybe a half a mile out from the house or something like that, we didn't have time to go back for lunch. So I can remember my sister coming out with sandwiches, jam and peanut butter or whatever, you know, and lemonade. And we'd sit down in the shade and just have ourselves a picnic. And we'd work until it was dark. And then we'd have to come back and we'd have to get the cows in and milk the cows and bed them down for the night or so. And I tell you, farmer's work really never ends. It starts at sun up, and it usually ends when there isn't any light anymore. And these things are important.
Now, where did your father learn stuff about farming?
Well, I tell you, what he learned in the old country, I think, was not that important, because I recall.
This is side two of our interview with Mr. Jack D. Levin, and we were talking about where your father learned about farming.
Well, to answer your earlier question, I don't think that he learned very much about farming methods in the old country. He operated a mill there when he was a young man for one of his uncles, and this was a grinding mill where they ground feed, I suppose, and they ground flour and things of that sort. So he learned, I think, the hard way. He learned from his neighbors, and in some instances he was able to improve on these things. I suppose that one of the main requirements of a good farmer, besides intelligence, of course, is the will to do work. If you're a lazy farmer, then you're a poor farmer. Because I don't know whether I mentioned before that farming starts at sun up and it ends at sundown, so to speak. And we were always alert, even though we were what you would call new farmers or beginners, more or less, compared to some of the old timers. We were pretty much alert to some of the things that were going on. Now, we used to plant our own cabbage plants. In other words, we would plant seed in flats in the house, for example. And then we'd plant them early enough so that when they got to be a certain size, we were just about ready to plant them outside. But we grew all of our own cabbage plants from seed, and then we transplanted them. Now, I can remember one year there were worms. I don't remember the type of worms. And, you know, farm plants of various types are frequently beset by insects, by bugs, by worms that try to destroy what you've created. Now, if you're smarter than they are and you're prepared for it and you know the kind of a spray to use, or you can recognize them for what they are, you can save yourself a lot of trouble and you can save your crops. And if you're not aware of these things, you lose. And frequently you don't have a second chance. So I remember one year, we had read about these worms or things that bothered cabbage plants, and we had written away to the Department of Agriculture. In this particular case, I think they recommended that we use a poison spray called arsenate of lead. And so we bought some of that, and when we began to see some of these worms or things of that sort, why, we sprayed the plants with it, or even before that, in order to prevent the possible attack by these worms. That particular year, in that area, involving quite a few farms, my dad was the only one who had cabbage plants. Most of the other farmers had theirs eaten up and hadn't prepared for this or hadn't exchanged information with others around them. You know, you would think that farmers having a particular problem would talk to each other frequently and find out, well, now, what do you do for a situation like that? Or are you having similar problems? But it took a long time for this sort of a camaraderie to develop among many of these farmers. Most of them were just plain rugged individualists. But anyway, make a long story short, they came around to my dad, and he was the only one who had any, and he divided with maybe six or eight neighbor farmers there. He divided his whole production of cabbage plants. And I thought as a kid that was a pretty good thing. I don't know whether the others would have gone that far in return. But who knows, maybe it was his Jewish heritage, or maybe it was a feeling for his neighbor, I don't know. But he felt that he wanted to share. And of course, after that, they picked his brains, now what do you do here and what do you do there? And for many years, as long as we remained on the farm, my dad, even though he was the newest of the farmers in that area,
He acted as a kind of a father confessor for the others. They'd come around there, Joe, what are you going to plant this year? Or Joe, having some problems over there, what do you think? And it was a good relationship. It was a good relationship. What else can I tell you?
Well, there are lots of things. I could ask some things. First of all, how were your fortunes economically in the years you were there?
We worked hard, and the times, we moved on the farm in the fall of 1914. Mm-hmm. It's about the time World War I started. And we were on the farm until 1920. We moved back to the city in 1920, which was, almost 6 years later. We made money on the farm. We worked hard, but my dad, instead of taking cabbage to the place where they made sauerkraut, which was fairly close by, most of the lazy farmers used to do that. Well, my dad would load up his wagon. Didn't have a car in those days. Didn't have a truck in those days. He'd load up his wagon and hitch up maybe three horses over there and take it to the city and get there early in the morning at the market and sell his cabbage, and so we made money. And so we did quite well on the farm. And when we sold our farm, we had a big auction. Of course, farms in those days didn't sell for very much money. I think our 80-acre farm probably brought us maybe $9,000. Mm. It's worth a lot more today.
That's a good chunk of money in 1920.
Oh, I remember we used to have visitors on the farm. I don't know, these things might... they're not directly related to farming, but they do have a little bearing on some of the people we knew at the time and so on. I can remember Dr. Simpson S. Markson, who in later years became a dermatologist, and I think he was head of the Department of Dermatology at Marquette University Medical School. But when he first came to Milwaukee, my mother was one of his first patients, and he was a general practitioner. A very dedicated person, a very dedicated doctor. When we moved out to the farm, he'd come out occasionally, and especially, I was thinking that maybe this was after the flu epidemic, but he'd come out to visit us on the farm. Now his wife was what my mother used to call a Yankee. Now, what's a Yankee? Well, I suppose to her, a woman who dressed well and who had ideas, maybe today you'd call her, you wouldn't call her an emancipated woman, but she was far, far ahead of what my mother could do or would do. She dressed much better, she spoke English much better, and so on. Anyway, that was my mother's reaction. But at any rate, Dr. Simpson Markson would come out to the farm, and I'd grab him, because he was one of my favorite people, and I'd take him through the barns and out into the pastures and everything, where you'd have the smell of horses and cows and manure and leather and all that sort of thing, and he just loved it. And when he'd come back, my mother would always fix him what she called a goggle moggle. Now, you know what a goggle moggle is? If you don't know what it is, I'll tell you.
I do, but maybe the people listening to the...
Well, it's a combination. It's a combination of eggs and milk. And you'd beat it up, and maybe even add some honey to it occasionally, or some sugar. And to my mother, this was a cure-all for everything. If you had, if your throat was a little bit sore, if you had a cold or whatever it was, she started with a goggle moggle. And of course, Dr. Simpson, even though he was a doctor, he couldn't get away from the goggle moggle, and he would enjoy it. She says, "These are fresh eggs, doctor, from my own chickens." She says, "I got to take care of you, because when I needed you, you took care of me." And we'd be gone for maybe an hour. It would seem like he'd regained his youth, and he forgot all the trials and the tribulations of a doctor, and all the problems that he had. And they were pretty regular visitors. He used to love to come out, although his wife didn't enjoy it that much. But he did.
Yeah.
Quite a person, yeah.
What about being Jewish with the neighbors? Did this mean anything with your relationship with the neighbors?
No, actually, I didn't learn what anti-Semitism was until many, many years later. What they thought in the privacy of their own homes, I don't know. But we got along with them as people. And, oh yes, they knew my dad was a Jewish farmer and all that. And maybe that was one of the reasons they used to come to him for advice. They used to figure, well, Jewish farmer would really right be with it. He'd be up with the latest things, and he'd really research it and that sort of thing. And no, we had no particular problems. But of course, there wasn't much of a chance to practice Yiddishkeit, so to speak, on the farm. And of course, during the high holidays, we'd come to the city, and we'd pray. I can remember going to the old home on Central Avenue in Milwaukee. My dad used to call it the Meshiv's Kanim. In other words, Moshav's Kanim. Well, anyway, it was the old home. And sometimes we'd go to the old Litvish Shul, which was located on 5th Street in those days. Yeah. It was an Orthodox temple. As I got a little older, of course, when we left the farm in 1920, I was only, well, 19, yes, I was about 13 years old, yes, maybe not quite 13. At any rate, we had a lot of books, and later on my dad used to get these so-called premium books from the Mtog, from the Jewish newspaper. And some of them were in English, some were in Yiddish, but it didn't stop me from reading the old legends, the biblical legends. And one day I had a foolish question, and I'd argue with my dad. Now, you know, with Lot's wife, I wouldn't believe that she could turn to a pillar of salt. And I said, when we're going to the city for the high holidays, I'm going to ask the old Rav, Schoenfeld. Now, Schoenfeld was almost like a chief rabbi in this city for many years, and he was accepted by all the congregations.
Yeah.
He was a very saintly person and a very learned person. And I can remember sitting next to him one day at this, during the high holidays at the Meshiv's Kanim. And just prior to that, I told my dad that I'm going to ask him. And my dad said, well, he said, if you ask him anything foolish and to embarrass me, he says, you're going to hear about it. And he said, so you better just watch your words, you know. And so in a lull in the services, I had asked the old rabbi. And he was a very understanding person. He said, have you ever heard of volcanoes? I said, sure, I know all about volcanoes here. I might have been 11 or 12, maybe 11 years old, but I know all about volcanoes here. Well, he said, in that area of the Near East, Israel, Palestine, those areas there, wherever they were, the biblical lands, he says, there were volcanoes probably. Now, he said, you know how women are. He said, if you tell a woman yes, she'll say no. And if you tell her no, she'll say yes. Now, this to me was an education in feminine psychology, but I didn't know it at the time. It was just beginning. So he said, it's very possible. So he says, I don't say that it's true. Now, here's an Orthodox rabbi. Mm-hmm. He says, I don't say that it's true, but it's possible that maybe she decided to turn around and look, and maybe got caught by the lava. And to the people in the distance, it looked like she was turned to salt. Now, he said, as a rabbi, he says, I don't know that happened. But he says, if it will give you any peace of mind, he says, maybe that's what happened. He says, I don't know. And so I thought, well, here was a very bright person. Here was a very saintly person. And everybody respected him. And I said, he took the time to talk to a child, to try to explain to a child certain things about the Bible and things that bothered, you know. Well, we didn't have much of a Jewish education on the farm. I'd say we'd have next to anything except reading. My dad did read to us later. He used to read us many of the Jewish legends and things of that sort. We used to have to talk about the Hebrew, the stories of the Bible, that sort of thing. But that was really the extent of it.
And you kept Shabbat?
No.
No.
No. You couldn't keep Shabbat on the farm. Because you had to feed the cattle, you had to feed the horses, you had to milk the cows, you had to do your farm work when it had to be done. So my dad explained, well, that was necessary, and it wasn't something that we created, and so we couldn't keep the Shabbat. No. But we did, my mother did keep kosher, she kept milchik and fleishik, she had separate dishes, we had separate Pesach dishes. Oh, absolutely, and during the Pesach, no bread. We followed the traditions, the daily, At the start, we used to, my dad used to make kiddush on Friday night. As time went on, it became easier not to do it, and so forth. But that that really didn't hurt in the ultimate, because now my wife and I, we have made kiddush for many years. We enjoy doing it, whether our children are here, whether the two of us or three of us. And so I'll tell you, the basics you don't lose regardless, see? I mean, there are many other things. I don't know just how far you want to continue with this, but
as far as you've got breath to do, really.
Punch it. Well, now there's another aspect of farm life that you might be interested in, and that is that in those days, and this of course went on for many generations before this. The farmer had to be a kind of a jack-of-all-trades because he was far away from specialized mechanics and specialists of any nature. So he had to learn to help himself, no matter what. For example, my mother, just like other farm women, did her own cooking, did her own baking, did her own canning, and there's a tremendous amount of this that we put away during the year. In fact, we made our own butter. We had one of those churns where you... you know, used to swirl those things by hand. Of course, that was a job that none of us kids used to like, although we used to like to drink the buttermilk afterwards. In fact, we one time, I think, some of the women used to make their own soap. I think we tried it one year, and after that, my mother decided that she wasn't interested in making her own soap anymore. They used tallow for that and lye and that sort of thing. I know that Dad and myself made a couple of hay racks. Mm-hmm. We built a few outbuildings there, sheds and things of that sort. But this is what you had to do. And if there was a breakdown on a piece of machinery or something like that, if it was something just ordinary, we would make our own repairs. If it was something a little more complicated, then my dad would say, "Jack, take the horse and go down to the blacksmith, which was maybe about a mile or a mile and a half away." Mm-hmm. And show them the old part, and the blacksmith would hammer out a new part and drill it, and so we'd put it back in place, and everything would be fine and dandy. We never ran out of work on a farm. Now, I suppose my dad was no different than anybody else, but certain jobs had to be done. Chores like milking and feeding the cattle had to be done daily, feeding the horses, repairing harness. For example, we had a corn sheller, and here again, lacking a motor, we used hand power. Yeah. And who provided the hand power? The kids, if possible, or the hired hand. And so we'd feed corn in there, and we'd shell the corn, so we'd have it for seed, or we'd have it to feed the chickens, and that sort of thing. There was always something to do.
And when you did get supplies and stuff like that, where did you go?
Well, my dad tried to get to the city when he had things to do during the season. I mean, he'd get to the city pretty regularly, maybe every other day with a load of produce, and then he'd come back. And I can remember, you know, you stop to think as to what appeals to kids. Maybe today you like an ice cream cone, or you like this, or you like that. My dad used to bring back pumpernickel, and in those days, I think they had the finest pumpernickel in the country, right in Milwaukee. It was an old bakery named Krasno's Bakery on 6th Street, and I think that people used to come from all over, from Chicago and all over, to buy her pumpernickel. It was really the finest. And I can still remember that when my dad brought fresh pumpernickel home, and we'd take some of that homemade butter and eat a piece of pumpernickel, that to us was one of the finest things. We didn't care for sweets or anything like that, but pumpernickel with a thick layer of butter on it was really something that used to send us. Well, once in a while he'd bring some candies, but that was far and in between. Of course, my mother did a tremendous amount of baking, bread and rolls, and what we called kuchen.
Yeah.
What do you call kuchen today?
Cake is...
It's not a cake.
Gertrude,
what is it?
It's almost a sweet roll.
It's a yeast roll.
It's Yeah, it has to be seen to be. It has to be really seen to be believed, I guess, or tasted, really.
But in those days, everything had to be done at by hand, and I can remember getting up sometimes. You know, children get a little worried at night or whatever it is. I know, getting up early in the morning, and here I'd see my mother bent over her wash tub with her old what do you call those old boards? Those rubbing boards. A scrub board. Just scrubbing away to beat the band. It's really something, some of those memories.
Did the flour come from the mill nearby?
The flour we bought in Milwaukee. Yeah. We would use Pillsbury's, or I don't remember some of those names anymore. But we had flour. We used to buy flour by the bag, by the 100-pound bag, and sugar by the 100-pound bag. And we'd have those things. Of course, other things, vegetables, potatoes, things of that sort, of course, those we had of our own. And on this particular piece of land, we had a pretty good-sized orchard, apple orchard. And we had, northern spies and other apples over there. And so we used to pick apples, we'd make cider, and we'd put away some of the apples for winter. I don't know how people preserve them today, but I remember in the old days we would pick the finest apples and make sure that they weren't overripe, and wrap them individually in newspaper and put them away in the fruit cellar, which was a dark place underneath the summer kitchen. The ground, incidentally, in the basements that the farmers had, there was no floor, there was no concrete floor or anything. It was just ground underneath there, you know. And maybe there was a certain amount of humidity or whatever it is, but you could preserve things there fairly well. You know, speaking of that, it reminds me one day, we had made, my dad had taken a bunch of apples to a cider press, a fellow had a cider press, and we had filled up a barrel with cider. Mm. We used to like cider. And, well, sometime after this, we were minding our own business. I think we might have been maybe eating supper or something. And all of a sudden, it sounded like an explosion, Lord knows what. And we went downstairs, and here the cider had generated so much gas, by fermentation apparently, that it had blown out the stopper and everything else. And here this cider was just shooting up there like an oil well going wild. Oh, I tell you, that was really something. And my dad didn't feel too bad. He said, well, what's the difference? But the kids felt bad because here we were going to be out of cider. We knew that my dad wasn't about ready to buy it. Oh, it was really something. There's so many of these memories from the farm. I don't know. I can't recall them all. Yeah. But
now, what about school days? Where did you go to school?
Oh, well, there was a school about a half a mile from us, called the. It was called the Neeland School, Kneeland, Neeland School, in the town of Raymond. It was just a single room school. We had a teacher there, probably. Maybe 18 or 19 years old, and these teachers had to be—they had to have good backbone and good common sense, and they had to be tough in their way. I don't mean tough that they were disciplinarians, but to cope with some of the older kids who were in the class frequently. I remember there was one in this group of about, what do we have, maybe 30 or 35 children. In all the classes through eighth grade. I can remember the time that I was ready to graduate. I was age 11. And we had a chap in the class who was a slow learner. He was a nice boy, slow learner. He was the son of one of the farmers. And I remember the teacher telling me, well, I think we're going to have to graduate Gene in your class too, because he's 16 already, and I don't want to keep him around here any longer. And so Gene finally graduated, I suppose by, I don't know what the standards of graduation were in those days. But it was an interesting class. And we had a teacher who, even by today's standards, was a very excellent teacher. I suppose that maybe she had 2 years at the Racine Kenosha Teachers County Training School, and maybe that's about all the schooling she had. But she used to give us a lot of mental arithmetic and things of that sort. And I found that in later years that this particular practice in mental arithmetic her stress on spelling and things like that were fundamentals that stayed with me through high school and through college years and were of great value. And I found that many of the pupils who had been trained in city schools who hadn't been exposed to this type of teaching were actually way behind me. So her methodology was excellent. You know, there's a funny there's a payoff to this. Was that still operating?
Yeah, it's still. I just want to make sure.
When we finally got back to the city in 1920, my dad wanted to register me over at North Division High School, and it must have been the middle of the semester, and I can remember the principal there telling my dad, "Well, Mr. Levin, first of all," he says, "your son graduated in a country school out in Racine County, and I don't know that he'll meet our educational requirements. And furthermore, I wouldn't take anybody in the middle of the semester." Bing, bing. So at any rate, my dad, being what he was, stormed over to the superintendent of school, Superintendent Potter, who was the superintendent of schools in Milwaukee County at the time, pounded the table and said to the receptionist, "I want to see the superintendent of schools." "Well, he's busy. Well, you tell him that I'm a taxpayer and I want to see him. He better come out and talk to me." So Superintendent Potter, very nice, understanding person, came out to see my dad and kind of relaxed him a little. What was the problem? Well, he said, "Mr. Levin," he said, "your son has a certificate which shows that he graduated from a Neyland school at age 11. Now, we don't know what their standards are and whether they meet our Milwaukee standards. However, I will stamp his diploma, and he will be conditionally admitted to the Milwaukee high schools. And if during the first month he doesn't make a creditable grade, he's going to have to take other work before he can come back to high school. But if he does, he can remain." And it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I discovered that it wasn't necessarily whether you graduated from a country school or not. It was the teacher you had frequently. Yeah. And it was your own motivation and your own interest in education which determined whether you comprehended or whether you didn't comprehend.
Agreed.
So that didn't get to be a problem.
Yeah.
It wasn't a problem anymore. And in those days, in the 20s and so forth, I was able to graduate from high school in 2.5 years.
Wow.
I went to night school, went to some summer schools, and at South Division High School, my teachers allowed me to carry 6 full credits every semester as long as I maintained an A average, which wasn't too difficult. So what else do you want to know? I don't know.
Okay, well, just, you know, why the farm? Why did your father sell the farm?
Oh, well, the work was hard. And during the war years, World War I, it was impossible to get any hired help.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, a farm of this type would require at least one hired man. Mm-hmm. We had one part-time, and then it became impossible to secure another one. So my mother worked very hard. The children did. My dad did. That was one of the factors. The other factor was that being Jews, we had no chance to establish any Jewish relationships there. Your Jewish education or anything of the sort. There weren't any Jewish people living around there and so forth. So that was another thing, I think, that caused my dad to finally decide to come back to the city. And so when we came back to the city, he said, "Jack, you got to be bar mitzvah." I said, "So, got to send you down to somebody's school." So whose school did I go to? The New Method Hebrew School, which was just starting in those days. Rabbi Garfinkel. So when Rabbi Garfinkel found that Jack Levin could read and write and speak Yiddish, instead of my learning Hebrew and the brachot and everything, I became an unsalaried Yiddish teacher.
Really? Wow.
So what I picked up on the run was enough to get me by. But it was one of those things. So, well, of course, one thing led to another, and my dad went into the grocery store business on the South Side.
Were there any other Jews in the South Side?
There were quite a few Jews on the South Side in those days. Yes, there were quite a few who were in business, and dry goods, grocery stores, and things of that sort, small business. Mm. And of course, I went to South Division High School at the time and graduated there and went on to the university. Became an engineer, traveled around the country a lot. As a matter of fact, you know, as I mentioned to you before, Jewishness is not necessarily a matter of observing all the things. If you find yourself in a position where you can't, it's a matter of feeling. It's a matter of many things, of your feeling for your own culture and your own traditions. And I can remember when I was a young engineer out in Montana, and I spent many years out there in wilderness country, working on the Canadian border. At one time, I had about 1,000 miles of the Canadian border. I built customs and immigration stations for the United States Treasury. And there were times there where, like for 2 years at a time, I didn't see a Jew. These were isolated areas along the border. I mean, I mixed with Gentiles, of course, and with Mormons. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was almost absorbed into the Mormon Church. That's another story. It doesn't relate to the farmer. Like that. You know, I was very curious about things, and for lack of something else to do, I did a lot of reading and things of that sort. And at Cartson, Alberta, which was located about 20 miles north of the Canadian line, the border, out in Montana, Cartson, Alberta, they had a very fine Mormon temple. That was the seat of Mormonism. Mm. And I remember reading all the books they had and got acquainted with the president of the Mormon stake. It must have been about 80 years old at the time, President Wood. And I read the Book of Mormon and the Pearl of Great Price and all these things. They relate a little to Judaism, but at any rate, after about 2 years, the old man said to me that he'd like to take me through the temple, invited me to take me through the temple. And I felt it was a great honor, because normally when a Mormon temple is dedicated, they won't take you through there, you know. So we were walking up over there, and walking up through the baptismal font, he said, "You know, Levin, I could baptize you and make..."